This week on Retronauts, not on my Game & Watch. That's right, I just came up with that joke just now, and I'm using it. Because this is Retronauts, episode, according to my notes, 353. And I'm Jeremy Parrish, and we are here to finish up some unfinished business. A couple of, I guess, months ago, I Skyped with Matt Alt and Bill Mudrin to talk about Gunpei Yokoi. And now the four of us, Bill, Matt, and Gunpei, and I, are all back together here on a podcast to talk about stuff. Gentlemen, I've kind of introduced you, but I'm going to let you introduce yourselves again. So let's start
alphabetically
with last names. So Matt.
I'm Matt Alt. Thanks for having me again.
I said Alt, not Alt.
No. It doesn't matter. It's funny. It's just like the key on the keyboard.
Right.
Matt Alt. But it's fine. And I'm the co-author of Pure Invention, How Japan's Pop Culture Conquered the World, which talks about all sorts of gadgets, including some that Yokoi made that changed our lives.
Truly, and it truly did. And then over in Portland, I believe, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Still.
But which Portland? There's so many.
Yeah. I'm Bill Mudger, and I'm just an artist guy who does drawings of pop culture things.
Including the slipcover for a book on Virtual Boy, which was designed by Gunpei Yokoi. You see, it's all circular.
Well, the book was designed by you. The Virtual Boy was designed by...
The slipcover.
Oh, the slipcover was drawn by me. Okay, yes. I wasn't quite sure if that information would be out there by the time this episode goes live.
I don't care.
That was a fun project. And also, doing the artwork for that slipcover meant I got to watch repeatedly every Virtual Boy video that you put up.
Repeatedly? Wow.
Well, I had to screen... Like, a lot of the artwork on that slipcover was derived from, like, you know, screen caps and stuff like that. So I was going... scrubbing back and forth all over that stuff. So
nice.
Thank you, Jeremy, for helping so much with your own project.
Yeah, right.
In that regard,
I'm happy to be the definitive source of something. That's great.
Oh yeah, no, seriously, you've definitely produced the most high res Virtual Boy footage available on YouTube, at least as of Christmas 2020. Yeah.
But it's not red and black, which makes some people very angry.
Oh, God,
but it's better
so
than
better.
Red and black.
Seriously, I was looking at some red and black footage like from like 8 years. You know, other people tried to record Virtual Boy footage, and that stuff is just like, just even watching the like other people's YouTube video of that stuff just on a TV screen or on a laptop was eye searing. I can't imagine. I mean, I've actually used the Virtual Boy in real life, but it's funny that even just watching video footage of that stuff is
red was already really out. But you remember, like, I don't know if you remember, like in the 70s, they had those red digital watches, mm-hmm. and they had all those like, kind of weird colored CRTs and stuff. And like, I thought humanity was past that by the time the Virtual Boy came out, but I guess not.
We'll talk about that more later. But you know, it was kind of a throwback to like the Milton Bradley and Mattel electronics with the LEDs. Like the little
primitive
games. Yeah, like the football game and like the all of those.
I had a basketball game that was in a kind of like basically a basketball shaped and molded disc. And you could tell you were supposed to be playing basketball because the plastic case it was in was a basketball. Otherwise, it was just red dots moving around.
Right. It's like those old like 10-in-1 TV games where you could play like Pong or like Song or Dong or Wrong. Like
I don't think
like
I want to play
like
Dong.
Variations on the same thing. You know, hockey, but it's just like what? Like instead of the paddle being flat, it has like a little J shape on the bottom or something like that. I don't know.
And that actually kind of segues into our topic for this episode or the beginning of this episode. So last time, instead of talking about the entire legacy of former Nintendo designer Gunpei Yokoi, we ended up talking about his work up through like the end of the 70s. We did not get as far as we expected, but that's okay because now we basically have the video game relevant stuff to talk about now. And I can't remember if we talked about the arcade games that he worked on. But
I don't think so. I think we just got we talked up to like Elekonga.
Yeah.
And like Nintendo's, you know, like the making ramen and the love hotels and stuff like that. And we just realized we were about to step our toes into the digital era of, you know, games and stuff like that. And then,
we talk about, I think the key pivot here is, did we talk about just like how derivative and copycat Nintendo was as a video game company in those very
early years? I think we were just about
years?
To get into that stuff.
Yeah, we did talk a bit about that, yeah.
Because it was, they were, you know, and like that, really that was, copycat derivative.
That was kind of the great tradition for everyone who wasn't creating something kind of groundbreaking, was that you were just making video games that were the same as something someone else made and made money on, but, you know, with a slight difference to it. And sometimes,
well, that's how you survive.
Even not a slight difference to it. Like, I mean,
yeah, sometimes just the same thing.
Yeah, like SF High Splitter. Wasn't that their big clone? SF High Splitter? Like, it was Space Invaders, except like you would shoot them and they would split into two or something like that. I know it's
no,
like
that's
a,
Space
it's
Invaders a, Part Two. In Space
no,
Invaders
also,
Part,
there's also a Nintendo knockoff of that.
Yeah, in Space Invaders Part Two, there are some invaders when you shoot them, they split into two. So that was Taito's own idea. Nintendo made a few different Space Invaders clones or derivatives, including Space Firebird and Radar Scope, which of course is the one that was an infamous failure. And the idea with Radar Scope is that it was pretty much just Space Invaders, maybe a little more leaning toward the Galaxian side of things, with movement beyond just marching back and forth for the aliens. But it had this kind of like skewed semi 3D perspective to kind of give you the sense that you're shooting off into the distance. But yeah, it was a modest hit in Japan, and then for whatever reason, Nintendo was like, this is going to be the way we make bank in America. This is going to be huge. So I believe they put in an order for two, don't quote me on this, but I believe 2,000 of them, and had them.
Yeah, 2,000 is what I've always heard.
Distributed, you know, shipped over to America. But Space Invaders was never that big here. Like, it was popular, but it wasn't the phenomenon that it was in Japan. And, you know, it took like 2 or 3 months for their boats full of Space Invaders clones to make it from Tokyo to New York, where their distribution was. They didn't even have, like, you know, they weren't based in Seattle at that point. They were based in New York. So it wasn't like they were going just across the Pacific. They had to, you know, freight it across the continent or whatever. And so by the time it arrived, American distributors were like, pass. So they were left with a warehouse full of they were left with a warehouse full of Radar Scope cabinets, and everyone knows the story. That's where Donkey Kong came from. But, you know, Donkey Kong was not just Shigeru Miyamoto saying, "I, the golden child of Nintendo, shall, you know, spring forth from Hiroshi Yamauchi's skull, you know, fully formed in my adult form, and save Nintendo." Like, Donkey Kong was a collaborative effort, and Gunpei Yokoi was part of the team that helped put that together. He was, you know, kind of the guy who was overseeing Nintendo's gadgets and games and gizmos, and video games were definitely that. So,
And I think it's really key to say that Nintendo's general suckitude at making games in-house, because none of their games were made in-house. Like, they would come up with ideas, and then they would be sort of outsourced to this company called Ikegami Tsushinki, who is still in business today and makes broadcast grade TV monitors and like cameras and stuff like that. But they, as far as I'm aware, did all of the actual wiring and like designing of circuit boards and stuff for the arcade games. Other companies did that in-house. Nintendo outhoused it, as we say in the industry.
So, and, I don't think that's...
Is that correct?
Ikegami is Tsushinki. Yeah, that's correct. But I don't think that Nintendo was especially unique in that regard. A lot of companies did outsourcing like that. And in fact, Ikegami went on to work for Sega and put together a very Donkey Kong-like game called Kongo Bongo and also Zaxxon. You know, it was just like in the very early days, Nintendo didn't have that kind of engineering expertise in-house. So they're...
Well, they were a toy and card company. So it makes sense that they just don't have the infrastructure yet. They're not going to have an in-house programming
division. It was a specialized skill, and a lot of companies, a lot of, you know, video game makers were outsourcing at that point. It wasn't you know, this was in no way unique to Nintendo.
Were the big ones was Taito doing that? Because my understanding is that, like, you know, Nishikado actually like designed the circuit boards and wiring for
I think for this most part Sega was doing their stuff in-house. Taito was doing their stuff in-house. Who else was big back then? Namco was doing stuff in-house.
those are the companies that kind of evolved from, certainly Sega, from like, you know, making like jukeboxes and stuff. So they must have had like electronical engineering experience in the company, I would assume, so than a company like Nintendo.
Those were kind of the giants. But then you had everyone else who wanted a piece of the pie. They were scrambling to get in, making their Space Invaders clones or their Pong clones. They didn't necessarily have electrical experience. There were companies getting in from all kinds of, you know, side businesses or businesses that barely even touched on electronics and computing. So they didn't have people in house, and they would outsource. And that's where, you know, around this time, you started getting companies like Tosei and Micronics and all these other sort of infamous, you know, HAL was a company. They weren't engineering, but they were programming. You had all these companies.
Almost like middleware.
Yeah, they were basically like the ghostwriters for companies that wanted to publish and distribute.
Well, that's the kind of modernification of the game industry, isn't it? Like, because basically, you know, now like that kind of, I don't know, delegation of responsibilities for making a game instead of just being one guy or gal who comes up with like everything and has to not only imagine it, code it, you know, build it like it was in the early years. You have this kind of situation where roles are starting to get more specialized, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's just in the beginning. I just think that the Japanese side of the industry was much more open to the idea of hiring subcontractors. And so there were, I mean, that's, if you've ever visited the website Game Developers Research Institute, they're basically devoted to figuring out which subcontractor put together this game, you know, and they pick apart source code and they listen for distinct sound effects and, you know, like pause chimes and things like that and say, well, you know, based on this pause chime and, you know, the weird like lag on the way this one thing moves, we can determine that this was put together by this development house. And then they'll like find someone they know who worked at that developer or worked at a publisher that contracted that developer and say, like, do you remember working with these guys? And they'll be like, oh, yeah, that's fine.
It's technological forensics, archaeological forensics is really what that is. And well, I think the big two big things here you have to remember too. No one really knew this was an industry yet,
right?
And so it made sense that no one's really going to start investing in like in hiring tons of in-house programmers and stuff. Because as far as everyone knew, like Space Invaders was just a fad, and like 2 years from now, everyone's going to be doing some kind of other kind of electronic gizmo. But no one's thinking like, oh, in 5 years from now, this is going to be like an industry that could like rival like the movie industry and I think that. And the second thing too. Nintendo, at this point, it's a company filled with Rand Peltzers, inventors, gizmo makers. While Nintendo was in a space where they could probably build arcade cabinets by themselves, but they don't have anyone to make the programs that are going to be put onto those cabinets.
Right.
And so, yeah, there's no Steve Jobses or anything like that. And so, yeah, of course they're going to have to go to a third-party company to say, hey, here's the hardware, and we have some ideas for some games to put on the hardware. But we don't know how to make those games ourselves. And so of course that was perfect that they had Ikigami right there just to.
Yamauchi was like a real fad chaser, I think. You know, like that's
I guess he had to be in order to survive. I mean
It's not a diss. But he definitely like, and he and this will come into play again a little bit later in this conversation, I think, but it was his personal belief that any fad lasted only 3 years. Mm-hmm. That was it, and then you had to come up with the next thing. And so I'm sure that was on his mind when, you know, video games were coming into play. Oh, this is the thing for the next 3 years, which is exactly what you're talking about. Like, nobody knew this was going to be the next
genre. But that's a quick turnaround going from, Space Invaders was like 79, Donkey Kong was 81? And 2 years after that, they're building the Famicom. So that is a pretty quick, and they're building that thing in-house, too. That's Masayuki Imara. So that's a fascinating just like 2 or 3 years in Nintendo history there where it goes from like we're not quite sure what if this is going to be an industry to like we're going all in on this thing.
Well,
like
not just arcades, he knew a cash cow when he saw it.
Yeah. So
right?
And I mean that was a really smart idea because they got on the ground floor of home. I mean not that the Famicom was the first, you know, home video game system ever made or anything like that, but they just happened to hit right at the right time, and of course they had Shigeru Miyamoto making the right games for that. Not to say, again, Miyamoto was the only guy making games for that, too.
But what was the Famicom based off of? Its spec, according to Uemura and other things I've read, was it had to run a very certain video game well. That was its
life. Exactly. It was built into this, yeah.
What game was that, Jeremy?
It was Donkey Kong. And we're kind of getting off the main topic here, which is Gunpei Yokoi.
He's still tangentially in there, but talking about
but,
him.
But, you know, you kind of have these two big milestones. You have Donkey Kong, and you have the family computer, Famicom, 1983. And in between there, you have Yokoi making a much smaller, much more modest, but in many ways more important contribution to video game history. Maybe not more important than Famicom, but, you know, more original, definitely, more inventive. And that is the Game & Watch. And so, you know, while he was sort of the producer and kind of overseeing the division for Donkey Kong and, you know, really didn't even have that much involvement with the Famicom and the NES until the disk system came along in 1986, Game & Watch was definitely his baby. And it really, you know, we talked last time about his philosophy of lateral thinking with seasoned technology and, you know, taking extant technology, cheap, plentiful, readily available gizmos, gadgets, technology concepts, and twisting them a little bit, you know, like turning them and looking at them sideways and seeing, how can I make play out of this? Or how can I take a concept and simplify it, you know, strip it down so that play can be affordable and accessible to everyone? So things like the Ultra Hand and the Lefty RX, you know, the remote control card that only turns left, those were his babies. And Game & Watch was very much like that. It was a video game, but not really. Like, technically speaking, Game & Watch is not a video game because it does not have a video system. It uses an LCD display that is pre-printed with characters. It's just a digital watch or a calculator. But instead of you know, having numbers imprinted on the LCD, it has instead characters and game elements. And he, you know, his idea was basically to take that technology, turn the numbers into something different, and make video games out of it. And it was very simplistic and basic, but at the same time, it was a video game that you could slip into your pocket and play anywhere, which was pretty revolutionary. It wasn't the first portable video game system, but Micronics or Microvision.
Oh, yeah.
Mattel Microvision. No, Milton Bradley Microvision.
Milton Bradley.
Really good or usable. Like, it was brilliant, but it was expensive. It was clumsy. It was battery hungry. And, you know, it had extremely low resolution and, you know, every game had to have its own control system built in, which was, you know, versatile, but also, you know, just added to the expense and added to the clumsiness. Whereas Game & Watch was very inexpensive and it was so tiny. It was, you know, the size of basically like a thick credit card or maybe a little bigger.
Yeah.
And you could just slip it into a pocket, bring it out anytime you want, play, slip it back into your pocket when you're done.
I don't want to say it was practically disposable, but
no, God, don't say that. We were so worried about damaging that. They weren't easy to damage, but they cost quite a bit in the States anyway. I'm old enough to remember, I was born in 1973, so I'm old enough to remember kind of like playing before and after the Game & Watches came out. And like, there was a fad for playing with calculators even before the Game & Watch came out. There were actual like books of like tricks you could play on the calculator, and like, you know, you'd type in like numbers and flip it around and
spell
show your
boobies.
Yes, exactly. And so when the Game & Watch came out, it really felt like this natural, like, wow, somebody's finally done it. They actually turned a calculator into a game system, you know, like it felt like a kind of vindication of every time we showed our friends, you know, boobies typed into the calculator in a certain way. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that was the really, you know, Yokoi just had that genius for making the right thing at the right time. Like, it just felt so right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The Game & Watch.
Yeah. And I never actually owned a Game & Watch until very recently. In fact, since the last time we talked about Yokoi, I've kind of gone on a little bit of a shopping spree for a video project I'm working on. And it kind of feels like, oh, I'm finally getting this childhood realization here. Like these right. things that I would stare at in the catalogs, the Sears catalog, I would look, just like stare at the Donkey Kong Game & Watch and be like, I can imagine what playing this is like. It's so cool. I wish I had this, but I never did. And now I do. And it is, in fact, pretty damn cool.
And now you can look at them through Mandarake's window in Broadway in Tokyo, where they're all like $300 each.
Yeah, they're not cheap.
Like they scaled the money up from what it was when
you were
just
added an extra zero onto them.
Exactly. Yeah. They're just as difficult to buy now as adults as they were when you were 14.
Well, was it 30,000 yen now or whatever? Yeah.
Well, I mean, some of those are really, really expensive now. I'm not like super up on which are rarer or which aren't, but they're definitely, there's an entire store devoted to retro, several actually, devoted to retro gaming in Tokyo, and they're expensive there.
I was just reading something today. I didn't realize they came out with like 60 different Game & Watches
over
the years.
Yeah, there were tons, and there were lots of different form factors.
I thought there was like maybe a dozen, but yeah.
Good luck collecting all those.
Yeah. There were tons of different form factors, and I wanted to do a video that included like every possible style, like every format of Game & Watch, but the crystal, the Game & Watch crystals are so expensive. There were like three games, including Super Mario Brothers, in the crystal format, which is just a transparent LCD. Like the entire body is clear. So you're like, you can play, and you know, you've got the LCD, which is piezoelectric or whatever. And so like the graphics show up in dark, but then everything else is clear. It's really cool. But those sell just as a system bare without a box or anything for anywhere from $800 to $1,000 each. It's just not worth it. It's really rad, but no, thank you. No, thank you.
Yeah. That's officially, like rolling up like $1,000 bill and just burning it just to smoke it for fun money. That's like, yeah, that's not practical at all.
No, man. I mean, I'd make a YouTube video with it, and that would bring in at least $20. So, you know, almost justifies it.
God, welcome to my world. As like a collector of vintage, like Japanese, like robot toys and stuff, everything's $1,000 these days, it feels like.
Did we even talk about the what was supposedly the legendary genesis of the Game & Watch was Yokoi on the bullet train or whatever, watching the other businessmen?
Well, he wrote that in his autobiography, and it's been reenacted on Japanese TV. It's kind of an origin story. I don't know,
we should obligated just to mention it, just because that's like part of the legend. But
yeah, go for it.
Well, isn't that it? He just saw people playing businessmen with the calculators, and he was like, "What if we made them like it could be like a toy they could be playing with, and it could be games instead of spelling boobies?" I don't think that works on a Japanese calculator, but the Japanese use numbers.
They definitely, actually, in Japan, it's probably even this is really off track, so I'll keep it short. But like numbers in Japan are phonetic too. So this is how Japanese schoolgirls invented texting in the 1990s by using pagers and putting in numerical messages that, if you read them phonetically, would sound like a sentence.
Huh.
So there is that. But, you know, yeah, I think the key thing about Yokoi and what's really interesting about that origin story is he's trying to make a toy for adults, like for Saturn.
Well, and that, of course, that has an echoes in the genesis of the Game Boy later and stuff like that, supposedly, but yeah.
So, yeah, and then the follow-up to that story is he tried convincing people in the company, nobody listened to him, and then Yamauchi's driver fell sick one day, and they forced Yokoi to drive Yamauchi around to his appointments, which he at first was really upset about, but then realized that he had a captive audience in the backseat and basically spent the entire ride, you know, haranguing a really disinterested Yamauchi in this idea of, we can, you know, turn a calculator into a game. And he thought it went nowhere. And then a couple weeks later, he showed up at the office, and it turned out that the appointment that Yokoi was driving Yamauchi to was at a dinner where Yamauchi sat next to the president of Sharp, the calculator company.
Kismet.
Yes. And a couple weeks later, when Yokoi was called into the office, which he was on a semi-regular basis, it sounds like, for doing all sorts of wacky things at the company, he was told, this is the guy from Sharp, you know, tell him your idea, let's see if we can make this happen. And that's how it happened.
Well, wasn't Sharp in a like calculator war with like Casio or...
Probably.
Or something like that, too. So I think it was also a thing, like Sharp was really... Well, also Sharp had an in with Nintendo because Masayuki Imura...
Yes, Imura came from there.
He
yeah.
first came to the company because he...
Yokoi recruited him. Recruited him. So
he was like, he came to Yokoi saying, hey, I've heard, like, we've invented these light-sensitive diodes that maybe you guys could use in your toys. And that was the genesis of the laser clay ranges and the little toy dolls with the rubber bands that's to support the figures that when you shoot them, they fall down and stuff like that. And they, Yamura became part of the company, and he wound up becoming Nintendo's chief hardware designer.
Yeah, there's another interesting connection between Nintendo and Sharp, which is that, you know, Nintendo ended up calling their first console the Family Computer, which it turns out was already the name of a microwave oven, I believe, that was made by Sharp. And so they had to like, they had to kind of work out a deal with Sharp to use that name. And that's why the Twin Famicom from Sharp exists. The all-in-one unit that is a console and a Famicom disk system. They made the Twin Famicom, or the Famicom Twin, or whatever it's called.
Yes.
And it is, I believe, a part of, like, you know, kind of the deal that they had to forge in order to use the name Family Computer. But I do want to go back to something Bill said earlier, which is that Gunpei Yokoi speaks like Zaphod Beeblebrox's psychiatrist, Gag Halfront.
Well, Zaphod's just this guy, you know?
Where did that come from, Bill? How is this canon?
Did I say that?
You didn't say it, but you were speaking in Yokoi's voice,
and it was very
like
that.
It was very like Austrian psychiatrist.
I mean, maybe he's the spirit just inhabited me for a moment. He was actually on the podcast we're talking about right now. Before I forget too, with the Masayuki Yamura connection too. Another important thing about Gunpei Yokoi, aside from all the technology stuff. He's kind of the nucleus through which all, like, the... Not all the people at Nintendo, but, like, he's the reason why Masayuki Yamura gets involved with the company. Genyo Takeda was, like, an assistant electrical engineer who was, like, repairing the laser clay ranges when they broke down, and, of course, he ends up becoming the guy who directed Punch-Out and designs all the memory mapper chips for the Famicom. And, like, you kind of just... The talent Nintendo just starts... Yokoi is like the little sun, and everyone's like these little.
He's the nucleus around which everything crystallizes.
Exactly. So they just even from a, like a personnel perspective, that's really kind of fascinating.
Well, and it's also, you know, there's this kind of persistent, or there was a persistent rumor going around that like R&D 1 and R&D 2, which are the two research and development teams inside Nintendo that worked on various projects, and I'm sure we'll get into this, were like at each other's throats, rivals. But the fact of the matter is Yokoi ran one and Uemura ran another. And when I interviewed him in Kyoto a couple years back, Uemura was like, there wasn't any rivalry. That guy is like my senpai. He hired me. There might have been a rivalry in the sense of, oh, look what, you know, Gunpei did. But I don't think there was any, like, we're going to get that guy, you know,
we're
going to
destroy
thing.
The other department.
We're going to blow up our own company.
Like, it's like National Lampoon's, you know, yeah, it's just what, yeah, Animal House, but it's...
I know that there was some kind of, like, you know, as projects scaled up or down, they would cannibalize each other.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it was fluid, you know, teams would drift back and forth as needed.
Again, it was still a small enough company. Everything's still kind of amorphous, even though they're separate divisions and stuff like that. But if something gets shut down, it figures like these people from over here would meld over here, especially if these guys over here need help and stuff.
Right.
So I do want to talk a little bit more about Game & Watch, just because I've recently like discovered how cool they are and beyond the abstract. But there were multiple.
So which Game & Watch did you get?
I picked up a few. You know, I had.
Oh, you got a few. Oh, wow. Okay.
Well, I had the reissued Ball from a few years back, and Ball was, you know, the first Game & Watch. It was a very small unit, and basically you are a little dude who moves left and right. Actually, you don't. You stand in one place and you move your hands left and right.
Your arms move left and right.
Yeah,
right?
You move your arms left and right to juggle balls. And it's kind of the quintessential Game & Watch experience. It's very simple. There are like two or three balls that are bouncing back and forth between your hands, and they're moving at different rates. And, you know, the tricky part is when they both end up kind of coming over to the same side at the same time, then you have to really move your hand on that side to catch both of them without letting one of them drop. And also, there's kind of like an ebb and flow to the pace of the game where it gets faster, 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 and then it slows down a little bit, and then it gets faster, 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 it slows down a little bit. So it kind of gives you like a little bit of a reprieve. And it's, you know, very well designed, considering it is such a basic, primitive game. But that's one of them. And that's kind of the basic unit. It just has like left and right buttons and no fire button or anything. It's just left and right because that's all you're doing is moving left and right.
That's before the D-pad, right?
Right. The D-pad came in with the dual screen systems, which was Donkey Kong, and that was basically like twice the size. It was basically like two Game & Watch ball units put together with a hinged joint in between, so you could close it. And what really surprised me about Donkey Kong when I got my hands on it is that it's really solid. Like, it feels dense. It's not, you know, it's not like heavy. It's not like, oh, wow, what a pain in the ass, what a burden. It just feels like amazingly well constructed. I think there's some metal in it and some plastic, like really good rugged plastics. And it has a good action when you close it. It just feels, you know, after 40 years, nearly 40 years later, it's still like, it still works, one, but also it just feels good. It feels solid. The hinges aren't all loose, you know, like Nintendo DS would. So there are some models that would get floppy after like 6 months. But the Game & Watch was just incredibly well constructed.
Over-designed in a good way.
Yes.
I mean, those things were carried around in backpacks and schoolyards and stuff, and Nintendo, I guess, by that point realized maybe they had to make them a little stronger than just the... Because now it seems kind of crazy you'd have an exposed LCD screen like that, anything you give to a kid, but... what is your memory of how did Donkey Kong play? Like, my memory of it was it was cool. Like, we were really happy, but it was a little janky.
Yeah, so I actually discovered, played Donkey Kong Game & Watch for the first time a couple of years ago doing a video on the Game & Watch Gallery, the Game & Watch collection for Game Boy Color. And It definitely, like, if you're expecting a pure arcade experience, it kind of throws you for a loop. Because basically the way it is, the way it's designed is that there's, like, moving sky hooks. And you have to kind of jump up and grab onto those to hang over above barrels that are rolling beneath you. And there's like a moving platform at the top that you have to jump on. It's kind of tricky, but it's kind of the basics of Donkey Kong that you remember from the arcade, but with a little more, there's a little more going on in the stage, like more dynamic moving elements, which, you know, it's not a pure interpretation of the arcade game, but rather kind of a reinterpretation that sort of reworks it to fit the Game & Watch format. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I'm watching a video of it on YouTube right now, and I'm kind of, I'm genuinely surprised at how they kind of messed with the format a little bit, which I guess they had to.
Yeah, otherwise it just would have been the same thing, right?
Yeah.
So was this the first one with the plus shaped D-pad?
Yes. Yes.
Which is really key because they actually, you know, I heard from Uemura that they actually used these or another Game & Watch with a D-pad as the prototype controllers for their prototype Famicom.
Mm-hmm.
They actually wired it into the Famicom, like, that they had that was on the, you know, operating table.
Makes sense. I mean, if you already got that hardware laying around, why not let that be the, you know. I wonder if that was, like, their first attempt I wonder if it was just very lucky that the first thing that they, the first bit of hardware they had lying around that they could kind of use as a ginned-up controller just turned out to be the most classic controller design video game history. But
there were other attempts to kind of come up with a Game & Watch interface. I want to say that there were, I'd have to look into this, but I'm pretty sure there were some Game & Watches that came before Donkey Kong that had four button direction controls that used like individual little buttons.
I've definitely seen those ones,
you have a left button and a right button. So, you know, kind of getting into that PlayStation style where you have separate buttons. And the genius of Donkey Kong was that the cross pad just combined all those buttons into sort of a rocker switch in four directions.
Yeah.
And
I've Yokoi has talked about that. He had written about how he wanted that specific sensation of being able to cradle your thumb in the rocker and just rock back and forth without having to worry about hitting individual buttons.
Yeah, it makes a big difference, and it survived for 40 years. Like, it's still kind of the standard for analog or for digital controls.
Well, as you remember very well, like, you know, one of the biggest issues with those old pre-Famicom game consoles that were sold in the States, like the 2600 or the ColecoVision or the Intellivision, was how sucky the joystick / directional control was. Was it the ColecoVision who had that like golden disc thing?
No, that was Intellivision. Yeah, ColecoVision was like a little flat mushroom. It was also bad.
Yeah, and they're just terrible, terrible stuff. And so one of the big things I remember when the Nintendo, the NES came out in the States was just like how complete it felt.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, this is just right. As opposed to, you know, like the simplicity, like the Atari 2600's joystick is awesome as like a kind of piece of designed consumer electronics equipment, but like it's only really usable for a couple times. There's no finesse to it. You know what I mean? That D-pad is just, there's something about it that was just like, you almost can't imagine it being designed any other way.
Yeah. And you know, people have tried, like the Master System had a D-pad that was a square, and yes, it was really bad because like, I like the hardware, but I find the games really difficult to use on Master System hardware because my fingers always stray to the diagonals. And likewise, yes, you know, PlayStation said, well, we can't just use the cross pads, so let's separate the buttons so that you get a blister on your finger, especially if you're playing like a fighting game. Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Nintendo patented that D-pad design, right?
They did, but I think people kind of figured out ways to sort of fudge it.
Wait a second. I thought Mr. Yamauchi said that he didn't want to patent things. He wanted to help the industry as a whole. Didn't he say that?
That sounds just like him. He was so altruistic.
Exactly, yeah.
The guy human... who was like, I don't donate to charities because I pay my taxes and that's enough.
Yeah.
God.
The living embodiment of Scrooge McDuck.
An under-reconstructed,
yeah,
like robber baron capitalist.
I just want to go back and redraw DuckTales comics just with starring Hiroshi Yamauchi.
So the Game & Watch form factors, I did have a Game & Watch that someone gave me a few years back, which is the more, like, the biggest outlier of this series, which is the Mario Cement Factory tabletop Game & Watch, which is more like those vacuum fluorescent display systems that Coleco was making around the time. The same time, like Pac-Man, Donkey Kong, you know, that were like bright and glowing.
Oh yeah, I'm looking at this right now. Someone's like online Game & Watch collection. I had no idea that was a thing.
Yeah, it's weird because the one that I have, I don't know if this is true of all of them. It takes two C-cell batteries, and they last for like 15 minutes because it's it seems to have some sort of illumination going on. I don't know. Maybe I'm using it wrong, but yeah, that thing just sucks down batteries. It's ridiculous. It's cool, but it's kind of big and it's sort of defeats the purpose of Game & Watch.
And no way to plug it in either, right? It's just
as
only
far as
batteries.
I know. Yeah, it's battery power only. There was also the multiplayer, a couple of multiplayer Game & Watches. I got one of those, Donkey Kong Hockey, which... So this is, it's a really cool system.
That's a good phrase.
I've never
Donkey
heard
Kong
of
hockey.
This.
Donkey
wow.
Kong
Donkey
Hockey.
Donkey Kong Hockey.
Yeah, so it's a two-player hockey game, and the way it works as a two-player game is that the system is kind of pill-shaped. It's like oblong and kind of rounded, and then the top of it actually slides up, almost like a drawer. And inside, there are two small round puck shaped controllers that are wired into the system, and you take them out and each player can hold one of these control pucks. And
interesting.
So then you kind of place the Game & Watch in between the two of you. And so one person is on one side, you know, defending one goal, and the other player is on the other side defending the other goal. It's like, talk about over engineering. Like this is, it's ridiculous, yeah, but it really feels like the precursor to the Switch and the Joy-Cons, like that, this is where it's from. You know, obviously these aren't wireless and they don't have HD rumble, but you know, the idea of like taking your game system, your portable game system, setting it down, giving each player one half of the controller and then playing together, like that is straight up what they did with Switch.
Yeah, this is a podcast, so you can't see the face I just made, but I totally did a Drew Scanlon white guy blinking gif at that. Like, oh yeah, that totally sounds like Switch, yeah. It's crazy to think. I mean, even aside from the game design stuff with like the 3-2-1 Switch stuff, where Nintendo's whole thesis of games as toys thing has still managed to survive long after Gunpei Yokoi left the company and left this world, but it's fascinating to see how that has become a core ethos to that company's mm-hmm. whole shtick, mm-hmm. and
And, you know, they were derided for it for a while, like, you know, around when they were kind of dragging their heels to get, like, the CD-ROM into their system in the early 90s.
Oh, and then, yeah, they had that, like,
when the Wii didn't do that well, like, there was a lot of joking about it. But, you know, like, I think there's a really kind of Apple-esque ethos to that where, like, consumer electronics, their raison d'etre isn't to be cool in and of themselves. It's to worm their way into your kind of lifestyle, you know what I mean? To make them part of your life in a way that is broadly appealing, not just to tech geeks.
They know play is eternal, so that's the one thing you can rely on Nintendo eventually circling back around to, is like, is this fun? Can anyone just kind of pick that up? Not to say that everything Nintendo makes sticks to that, but even when they lose their way, they eventually end up looping back around to, like, what's the most fun toy-like thing we could make with this technology?
Yeah. Right.
And,
no, it's true.
Yeah. That's, and that's
what, well, so much of those, especially during the console wars, like, you know, the way the Genesis looks is to me, it looks like something like a 13-year-old boy would brag about, or the Lynx. Yeah. You know, they're black, they're chrome, they're like, you know, they have these like aggressive, like carnivore names, like Lynx, you know what I mean, or whatever. Whereas like Game Boy or like almost anything Nintendo made was cool, but it wasn't gendered and it wasn't like really trying to be cool. It just was cool because it was so right. I've used this description so many times, it's getting boring now, but the first time you picked up that Game Boy, it just, like, you couldn't imagine a world without it. Like, I can imagine a world without the Lynx. I don't want to. But you can. But the Game Boy to me is like that Yokoi. He just had this genius for hitting a sweet spot that was like kind of cross genre, cross demographic, that is really tough, I think, for any company or designer to hit.
Yep, I absolutely agree. There is something very, I think, intuitive about his design sense. And, you know, Game & Watch was great because you got to see him and his team iterating on great ideas and continuing to develop them. Another system format that I didn't discuss is the color models. And there's one of those called Spitball Sparky, which is basically like,
I was just going to say,
it's basically, you know, Breakout with a little bit of a kind of game twist to it, but it has color, kind of the way Space Invaders does, with like tiers of color on the screen.
Cellophane?
Yeah. Sort of, something along those lines, yeah. It's kind of like that, like the screen is colored in stripes, basically.
Spitball Sparky.
By the way, I'm going to insist that you guys call me Spitball Sparky for the remainder of this podcast. It's the greatest, it's the greatest name ever.
That sounds like something Noir Spider-Man would say right before he knocks out a Nazi, yeah.
It's like, slow your roll there, Spitball Sparky! You know? Yeah. It's like... I love
God,
Japanese
what
can
saying,
break
though,
the
like,
English language in such beautiful ways.
That's half the appeal of Hideo Kojima games.
Well, Donkey Kong right there is just such a... I still think... I mean, Donkey Kong's a great name, but half of Donkey Kong is that name.
Yes.
Like, and I'm sure that's half the reason why anyone played it back in the day when it first came out. They're like, the hell's a Donkey Kong?
Right.
I don't think so. Like, I don't know, maybe because I discovered it as a very young child, but it just seemed right to me. It was just like, oh yeah, it makes sense. It's a big monkey called Donkey Kong. Of course.
Yeah.
Of course that's what his name is. And it just, it's euphonic. It just rolls off the tongue.
It's also really genius because King Kong's kind of scary, right? King Kong, he's like a kaiju. He's like a giant monster, right? And then Donkey, you put Donkey in front of it and suddenly it's kind of cute.
Mm-hmm.
So this is another really key Nintendo and Yokoi thing, is that they could make the cute cool. And because basically there's very little difference in, if you're looking at just as a pure design kind of perspective, between, there's very little difference between Hello Kitty and like what Mario looked like in those very early iterations. Giant bobblehead, little body, little boing, boing, boing sound effect when you're walking. Yet you felt cool when you were controlling Mario. You didn't feel like you were like being babyish or infantile or anything. And that kind of cool factor and cute at the same time, I think it's partly Yokoi. It's partly, of course, Miyamoto, who designed those characters. Yokoi didn't design the actual characters in the game, but that's a very Japanese, that's in Japan's wheelhouse. Do you know what I mean? And one of the big reasons I think its products took off so much in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and now.
Yeah, embracing that playfulness.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, that cute doesn't necessarily mean like uncool or unmasculine or anything like that. It's like it's almost like a filter that you can put over any experience.
Well, and that goes back to the treating everything like a toy. Like,
right.
play as a notion exceeds any kind of boundaries or any kind of gender or class stuff. Ever, no matter who you are, you like to play with things.
Yep.
But although I always wonder how much Genpei Yokoi is credited as a producer on all these games after the Game & Watch, and I always kind of wonder how much of a design input he had beyond just saying, hey, make this fun. Because it feels like Donkey Kong is mostly Miyamoto, and I know, like, Genpei Yokoi is credited as, like, not the director, but, like, everyone thinks that, like, Super Mario Land and all those early Game Boy games were Genpei Yokoi games, and they were not.
But in Yokoi's autobiography, he says that there's actually a big chunk on Donkey Kong in there, and
I would love to read that sometime. Yeah.
Well, his take on it is that it's Miyamoto's game, but that Yokoi came up with the idea of, he was the one who was inspired by a Popeye cartoon called A Dream Walking, which is from the
1930s. I just assumed that was. Okay, yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
He just says that, and it's whether, you know, this is in his autobiography, so I'm just quoting him now. And it's a 1930s cartoon, and Popeye was huge in Japan. Like, before Astro Boy came out in 63, like, Popeye was the huge fad. It was broadcast on, you know, nationwide TV in the late 50s and early 60s, and then in reruns, just like we saw it in America.
Yeah, and so around, like, this time, there was a boys' magazine called Popeye that was, like, be the stylish city boy, and there was also, like, a Bluto magazine, I think, and an Olive Oil magazine.
Brutus,
that's it, sorry. Yes, I forgot. He was Brutus at that time in Japan and in some parts of the US. Brutus magazine, and then Olive Oil, I think, was also one. And they weren't about the characters. That was just the names. But it was kind of like saying, like, basically, this is a magazine for, like, if you want to be kind of a hip, trendy city boy, then you read Popeye. If you want to be kind of like a Yankee, you read Brutus. And if you want to be a style savvy young lady, then you read Olive Oil.
We should have David Marks on. His book Ame Tora, How Japan Saved American Style, goes, like, really deep into that, about those magazines. It's actually Ivy Style is what it's called.
Oh,
it's
Ivy.
Like a,
okay.
And that was, like, a really big thing back then. But the point of this is if you look up A Dream Walking on YouTube and watch it, it looks like it's Popeye and Bluto, like, punching each other up and down off of girders. There's all sorts of obstacles and stuff. Olive Oil is sleepwalking, and, like, they're trying to protect
her. Oh, yeah, I've seen
her.
This one. This is, like, it's... Thank God it's Fleischer Brothers, or otherwise
yes.
it'd be...
Yeah, no, it's I'd awesome. So, like, it's a really great cartoon.
Raising my fist at Yokoi.
Yokoi took it, and so it was supposed to be a licensed Popeye property at first, Donkey Kong. And then that fell through, but they kept the general gameplay. So the question is, like, you know, who made Donkey Kong? Like, you know, Yokoi came up with the idea of characters on girders, like, you know, competing to get to the top. You know, Miyamoto is the one who came up with the characters that made it an awesome experience. And there's no question about that. But it's,
and that's,
you know,
kind of what I was saying. I could see Yokoi being mostly more like a guiding hand than the like boots on the ground. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's pretty much the role that Shigeru Miyamoto plays in games now. He's not out there like saying, you know, this level is going to be where you pick up a penguin and fly with it. He's just, like, you know, nudging everyone and saying, well, okay, this is okay, but there's probably a way to make this more fun. What would that be? And, you know, kind of pushing people, being their, like, their Yoda, basically. And, you know,
most famously Pokemon. You know, to the point that Tajiri actually named Gary Oak Shigeru in the Japanese version of Pokemon to kind of symbolize his rivalry with his rivalry and friendship with Miyamoto Shigeru, who was a really kind of driving force in guiding Tajiri. Like, I don't think, like, just like Jeremy's saying, I don't think he went in and said, make this level in Pokemon or anything like that, or add these Pokemons, pocket monsters. But he was,
you,
like,
you should make it
really...
so that if you, like, stand in this truck, then you can get Mewtwo.
they should have put, like, a Donkey Kong style pocket monster in there. I don't know. Actually, though, famously, the very first, like, the design docs for, like, when it was called Capsule Monster were made public a couple years back, and the kind of prototype screens that Satoshi Tajiri drew of pocket monsters fighting were Godzilla and King Kong. So that just goes to show you how much King Kong is kind of part of the DNA of Japanese pop culture, that he keeps coming up again and again in all of these kind of hit Japanese games. We'll be right back.
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing about the work that Yokoi's division did for the NES and Famicom is that they didn't really make games for Famicom. They pretty much made their games for the disk system add-on. Right. Like, all the games that you associate with R&D1 were Metroid, Kid Icarus, Famicom Wars, the Famicom Tante Club, Fire Emblem. Like, all of these were headed up or developed in collaboration between R&D1 and Intelligent Systems, and all of them were disc games. I really don't know why that is. You know, Yokoi did not have any involvement that I'm aware of with the actual design of the hardware. It was done at R&D2 under Uemura. Yeah. But, you know, for whatever reason, that seemed to be kind of where they specialized. And you didn't really see Miyamoto's R&D4 doing that many disc system games. It was mostly, you know, they did Zelda and Zelda 2 and Mario 2. But otherwise, they kind of focused more on cartridges, even after Nintendo had kind of given up on cartridges. You know, Super Mario Brothers 3, that was probably their biggest NES game, and that was a cartridge-based game. So there was definitely kind of this division happening. It was very interesting.
Kind of a weird leapfrogging with, like, Miyamoto being kind of in charge of some of the earlier games, and then...
Well, isn't it just like an age thing? Like, Miyamoto was younger, and, like, you know, for they knew that you wanted a young person in that role because you're appealing to young adults and young kids. So, like, Yokoi is already like a middle-aged dude. He's like in his 40s by this point, and is not, you know, he probably himself was realizing that he was kind of aging out of it to a certain degree. You know what I mean?
I also wonder, was Yokoi still just kind of focused on Game & Watch stuff while kind of essentially mopping up that stuff while the Famicom was kind of making
it? So, if I might, I have a little anecdote there. When I asked Uemura whether there was a game industry crash in Japan of anything, even a bubble, you know, a bobble, so to speak.
Some kind of, yeah.
Yeah, like related to the way, because, and he was, of course, aware of the great American video game crash of 1983, precipitated by, famously, by E.T. And he said, no. But there was a Game & Watch crash. And when Game & Watch crashed, everybody, like, people just stopped buying Game & Watches, and that was actually a big blow for Nintendo. They were really freaking out about what to do. So it's interesting that at least among the people at making the games, I don't know if, like, this is really widely as celebrated on the ground as, like, the American game industry crashes, the Game & Watch cratered. It stopped selling. Like, the fad was over. Roughly,
was there any particular
years.
Reason given for that? Did they flood the market, or?
There was a lot of product on the market, but as Uemura told me, he's like, well, like Yamauchi said, and he was generally right about this, fads lasted 3 years.
Oh, okay.
And Japan is very fad driven too. You can speak to this better than I can, but, like, things become really popular there, and everyone is like, I gotta do this. Everyone's doing this. I gotta do it. I gotta get part of this. Like, I wanna take part in this. I wanna participate. And then
novelty.
They're like, yeah, I'm done. Okay, I did it. That's great. I'm out.
Well, it speaks to how quickly Nintendo exited the arcade industry too. They went pretty much straight from arcade just to doing Famicom stuff.
More money.
And yeah, I never thought about the ebb and flow of, like, who was working on what and then. Because I could see Nintendo just keep on writing the Game & Watch thing for as long as possible and just keeping Yokoi on that while Miyamoto's working on early Famicom stuff. And as soon as the Game & Watch industry dried up, that's when they're like, okay, Yokoi, we're thinking about doing a disk drive system. How about you start thinking about that kind of stuff?
Right.
And
right.
Then, yeah, so it's Gunpei and Miyamoto, I guess, kind of leapfrogging each other.
Or was the disk system another way to keep the NES from going obsolete? Because, like, again, to bring up Uemura, when I asked him, like, well, so why are you targeting the American market? Is it because it's so big? And then he said, no, because we were coming up on 3 years of the NES and everybody thought it was going to just crater and the fad would be gone. So Yamauchi ordered us to approach America, not out of any sense of, like, you know, we're going to take this gaming to the world, but because, oh, we're going to lose all our profits in Japan. We better find a new place to make
just move everything over to. Yeah. Huh. That's
so
interesting.
I'm not exactly up on what the timing was of the disk system coming out. What year was that?
That was February 1986. We're coming up on 35 years.
Oh, wow. So it's way later. It's actually way later. So that definitely was not part, didn't have anything to do with the, or though maybe he was developing it for much longer than that. I don't know.
Well, you know, that was 3 years after the Famicom launched. And then Game Boy was 3 years after that.
Yeah, but, I was about to say that.
But a big factor in the Famicom Disk System's existence, from what I understand, is that, you know, Nintendo didn't have a licensing program in place for the Famicom right away. And so everyone was just jumping in and creating games. And there was, like, I've seen, you know, like, translated columns and text from magazines of the era saying, like, you know, there's a video game crash coming. It's just like this bust of quality. There's not good stuff coming out. And the disk system was a way to kind of circumvent that. It was, you know, it gave Nintendo more control over the output for the system. It had that very clever hardware lock out system where you had to have the word Nintendo engraved on your disk in order to function inside the system. And it, you know, boosted the capabilities of the system, at least for like a year or two until the cartridges leapfrogged it with the memory mappers. But it was basically just a way to refresh the console without actually creating a new platform altogether. And to give Nintendo more control over the direction of the Famicom market in Japan, whereas, you know, they built the 10 NES security system and licensing into the American and European versions of the NES. So they didn't have to worry about that so much.
Yeah, and was digital distribution, I mean, in the form of, like, they had those kiosks, right? The disk system
kiosks.
Yeah,
they had the disk writers.
That you'd go to in a game store and basically stick your disk in and get it overwritten by whatever game you wanted, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was like $5, 500 yen, as opposed to 3,000 yen for...
So basically digital distribution, digital delivery, a kind of prototype of that. Mm-hmm. I guess you had to physically walk to the website.
Yeah, basically. Sneakernet.
Although at least then you actually got some kind of a discount for engaging it, just like they were promising with digital distribution at the beginning of, you know, this current iteration of that. But no, just the publishers just hoard whatever extra profits they make from that. The consumer never gets a break on that. But
right.
Yeah, so what are we up to, the Game Boy now?
Yeah, I think so, because Yokoi R&D1 worked on Famicom Disk System for like 2-3 years, produced some pretty memorable and groundbreaking games, and then in April 1989, the Game Boy came out, and that was headed up. He was the project lead, Yokoi was, on Game Boy, the portable system from Nintendo. That was complete crap and successful because it was complete crap. He was not the only designer. He was not the guy who figured out all the circuitry and stuff like that. That was Satoru Okada.
Yeah, he has not good things to say about Yokoi, it seems, about in terms of like who's responsible for the Game Boy and stuff.
Ooh, interesting. Dish.
So Satoru Okada, I guess he wound up being responsible for the designing all of Nintendo's portable hardware from pretty much the original Game Boy up to... everything right up until, but not including the 3DS. And there's, I think it's, is it an interview that was translated by Shmupulations? He talks about, just Google Satoru Okada Microvision, because what he says is that once the Game & Watch fad died, you know, of course, Yokoi was like, well, we got to follow this up with something. Well, maybe we'll come out with a system with, like, you know, interchangeable cartridges and stuff. According to Okada, Yokoi's idea was to come out with like a really almost kind of like a Game & Watch, but with just interchangeable cartridges, to the point that he was saying we should do something like the Milton Bradley Microvision, but just cheaper and with crappier technology, and it'd be almost like, I don't want to say disposable, but Okada says that Yokoi was talking about the system, essentially you'd throw it away after two years because it was just not very cheaply well made, and it was kind of more of a disposable toy than anything else. According to Okada, he's like, I was the one who said, no, whatever our portable handheld with cartridges is going to be, it should be a portable Famicom. And according to him, he's the one, like, essentially he and Yokoi had a throwdown, where Yokoi's like, no, we need to make this cheaper, more toy-like. Okada was like, no, we made them need to make this, like, sturdy and give actual play value to the customers and stuff like that, and it has to be something... Yeah, it has to have some meat on its bones. Not to say that it has to be super expensive or anything like that, And supposedly Yokoi was like, well, if you're willing to take responsibility for this, I'll let you build this thing. And so according to Okada, he went off and designed the Game Boy single-handedly. But then Yokoi, I guess, took all the...
Well, this is like the great man theory of history, right? Like people love to kind of, you know, wrap up a very complicated design, but they want to put a face on a very what is actually a kind of very complicated process.
I don't want to misconstrue to make it sound like Okada says that Yokoi had stolen the credit, but I think he does seem to be, in the one or two interviews where he talks about this, he does seem to be a little bit salty that Yokoi, through no fault of Yokoi's own efforts, kind of became the face of the Game Boy, even though it sounds like it was totally Okada's idea and his. I mean, even people will admit the fact that he was the guy who actually designed the Game Boy. But, like, yeah, Okada's whole thing is, like, whose idea was it? Who was really pushing for it to begin with?
Yokoi's autobiography, he's basically focusing on the screen. And, like, all of his stress is about how bad the screen is.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, well, he says, like, he stopped eating. And he developed such, like, a bad case of ulcers that he was actually considering, I think he means this metaphorically, considering suicide. Like,
is it because
really,
it's blurry, or?
Well, just basically, I think that the big issue that they were running into was the viewing angle. And, like, if you just tilted it even slightly, and he kept showing prototypes of it to Yamauchi, and Yamauchi's like, get the fuck out of here. You can't sell this. And he was so worried that they wouldn't be able to come up with a screen that pleased Yamauchi and, like, the other higher-ups, and it would be canceled or something, that he got, like, incredibly stressed out. And so it's interesting, because in the biography, he doesn't really claim credit. He kind of skirts around the issue of who designed the Game Boy. He's basically just focusing on delivering the Game Boy. Which I can very more easily see.
Well, he's the producer, though. Like, even if he's not designing, he's still in charge of the project. And if anyone has to answer to Yamauchi, it's going to be him. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I'm just looking online here. Okada was interviewed by Retro Gamer magazine, I guess. And this site, JapaneseNintendo.com, says, you know, quote, when I was young, and this is Okada, I was rather stubborn and often became angry at my superiors when I was defending my ideas. The best example of this was the Game Boy. The Game Boy you know today actually had nothing to do with the one Yokoi had in mind. He saw the Game Boy as a direct follow-on from the Game & Watch, which meant a rather cheap toy with no business model and no long-term ambition. So that's basically, you know, what you were saying, right? That it was kind of, you know, Game & Watch Plus.
Almost exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know, that's the unfortunate thing of a bunch of white guys who have all this information from secondhand sources. We can never know for sure because of, you know, just the nature of the industry and everything like that is like the only two real sources we have for most of this stuff is like Game Over and Awada Asks and the occasional golden nugget like this interview with Okada. So we have to like kind of piece together a puzzle retroactively.
Yep.
But that makes him a little more of an interesting picture of exactly how the Game Boy was developed. It wasn't just Yokoi being like, I have an idea. I'm gonna invent a machine that one day everyone will play Pokemon on. It wasn't like that, yeah. So it's never as simple as that.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the Rashomon effect, you know what I mean? It's like you ask everybody and everybody has an equally compelling, completely different, you know, story of how it came to be.
They should make a movie about that.
They should. Jeremy, is this your podcast? You've disappeared. Jeremy.
I'm here. I don't have to dominate the conversation. You know, I think everything we're talking about right now is there's a high degree of speculation, and that's not really what I want to deal in too much. But, you know, the important thing is that Yokoi did have an important hand in getting the Game Boy project through. There were obviously some disagreements on the final form it would take. I know some people within Nintendo have also been said to have wanted the system to be much higher spec, to, you know, have a color screen and things like that. So, you know, every kind of project like this is a compromise, and what it actually ended up as is, you know, that's what we got, and it did the trick. It was very successful. One of the best, actually the best-selling game system of the 20th century. Kind of hard to argue that they didn't succeed.
I think an example of just good enough.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, Yokoi was involved in Game Boy throughout its life. R&D 1, the R&D 1 division was kind of the main internal team that worked on Game Boy software. Like if it was a first party game, it was probably headed up by R&D 1, maybe co-developed by Minakuchi Engineering or Pax Sofnica or some other co-developer, but you know, ultimately spearheaded by someone who worked under Yokoi in his division. And so you had games like Balloon Kid. Yeah, that's the first go-to, right? Everyone goes to Balloon Kid first. No, it was, you know, Balloon Fight, but with kind of like a single player quest mode that really built on the balloon trip concept and was really, really good. Super Mario Land, Super Mario Land 2 and 3, Tetris, Solar Striker, you know, all the kind of early sports games like tennis and golf and baseball, those were all R&D 1 intelligent systems working together. Metroid 2, there was a great Kid Icarus sequel, quite a few other games by R&D 1. I don't think Nintendo R&D 4 and Miyamoto got involved until Zelda, and that was like 1993. So the system was, you know, had been around for several years by the time R&D 4 was like, oh, yeah, you know, we should do something for this other system we have. Who knows?
Well, famously, the Super Mario clone, I mean, it's not a clone, it's by Nintendo.
I can't believe you called it Super Mario clone. That's so damning. That's worse than my Okada story.
I remember it was mind-blowing when I first played it, you know, as a kid. But, like, it's a weird Mario game.
It is. Yeah. And, you know, I've talked about this in some of my videos and projects before, but there was the timeline split, kind of like the Zelda timeline, but it was the Mario timeline. And there was like the hero of Mushrooms, and he went on to, you know, do Super Mario Brothers and all of its sequels. And then there was the blue collar hero who made Wrecking Crew and showed up in some weird random games from R&D 1. But the people who made Super Mario Land, including Hip Tanaka, the composer, and Yokoi, had worked on Donkey Kong. They had worked on Mario Brothers. You know, so they had this kind of connection to Mario, and they had a claim to the Mario legacy. They just hadn't worked on the Super Mario Brothers, like, that specific corner, that specific branch of the Mario series. So when they were given... when they were told, you know, make a Mario, Super Mario Brothers style game, they were like, okay, sure. But, you know, instead of following strictly what EAD or R&D4 had done, they were just like, let's kind of stick with what we know. So you get, you know, fighter flies from the original Mario Brothers in there. You get all kinds of weird stuff. You don't get the fireballs, you get super balls that bounce around the screen. It was just kind of them saying, you know, we've got our own take on Mario, and it's totally legitimate and fine. It's just, you know, not necessarily what you expect if you were a kid watching The Wizard and salivating over Super Mario Brothers 3.
Yeah, well, it's the ultimate expression of the idea that, like, there was no specific formula for any of this. Like, just like everyone talks about how, you know, those early NES games, the sequels were always weirdly different because there was no formula for any of those specific series that the developers felt obligated to follow. And of course, yeah, with this, without Miyamoto's involvement, there was no one to say, hey, this is what makes a Super Mario game and this is not. And I've always said that, like, if Yokoi was ever in charge of any actual game, it feels like Super Mario Land might be the one where you can most feel his fingerprints in, because it is such a weird toy-like little game. Just the idea of, like, instead of fireballs, what if it's just a bouncy ball? It just bounces and collects coins. It's just goofier and funnier. And what if every other stage was just like a little shooty stage and go shoot, shoot, shoot? It's so much more toy-like.
Yeah, submarine. Wasn't there a submarine stage too?
Yeah, and it was. But at the same time, it's so less refined. Which you could chalk up a lot of that just to being, you know, one of the first games that the development team was making for that system. You know, Mario feels kind of weirdly sticky and stiff. But like, yeah, there's something very fun and play-like in that game that I get the feeling that that was more of a Yokoi joint than any other video game you could probably point to in terms of, like, him coming up, like, maybe he wasn't designing the whole game. He was definitely not the director. He was just, quote-unquote, just the producer. But, like, if you ever wanted to point at something that kind of shows you the difference in game design philosophies between Gunpei Yokoi and Shigeru Miyamoto, Super Mario Land is it.
Well, it certainly hit a sweet spot when it came out. I mean, I think judging it now with the benefit of, what, 30 years of hindsight is a little uncharitable because, you know, it was designed for its era. And in the era, I certainly didn't, you know, feel like, oh man, this is like a fake Mario, man. Like, I felt like, wow, Mario handheld, like actual Mario handheld, you know, despite how tiny that sprite was. Like, he is tiny in that game.
Yeah, I don't think this was a Yokoi game. I mean, like, he produced it, but it was directed by Satoru Okada. He was the designer, like the planner on the game. Like, Okada had a hand in a bunch of kind of early Game Boy games. You know, he was the guy who designed the hardware. So, you know, most of the best games that take the best advantage of the system and kind of make the most effective use of it were designed by Okada.
Interesting.
Anyway, Game Boy was great, even though the Mario game was kind of weird. As you said, Matt, it was, you know, just good enough. Not very impressive on, you know, in comparison to the Lynx or to the Game Gear, but the batteries lasted forever. It had a great library of games because Nintendo, you know, everyone wanted a slice of the Nintendo business. It had, you know, it was very durable piece of hardware. It was portable. Yeah. Like, you could actually literally bomb it and it would still work. So,
literally.
Well, it got better pretty quickly too. I mean, that original DMG-001 brick was around for a while, but, like, Nintendo did start knocking out better versions of that hardware pretty soon, though.
Yeah, the Game Boy Pocket.
The Pocket.
Game Boy was 7 years old by the time that came out.
I thought that was just a couple years later. Sorry. I was thinking that was... that is a while. Oh, geez.
The Game Boy Pocket was 96. It actually came out around the same time in Japan as Pokemon. Like, that was kind of a shot in the arm for the Game Boy. That was Yokoi saying, you know, things didn't go so well with Virtual Boy, but I really want to retire. And he'd already been planning to retire before Virtual Boy. He did not leave the company in disgrace because of Virtual Boy. But, you know, he wasn't satisfied with how that turned out, that project. So he spearheaded Game Boy Pocket and said, you know, I'm going to make a Game Boy that really, it's more satisfying. It lasts longer. On you know, a set of fewer batteries. It has a better screen. It's smaller and more compact. It's just like the Game Boy perfected. And it is a great statement. Like, when you use a Game Boy Pocket, if you go back to the original DMG-001 brick, it's like, whoa, I'm playing it loud, but I don't know if I want to.
You know, it's funny. I think it's the fact that Pokemon came out on a game system that was like 7-8 years old, pretty long in the tooth for a game system back then, was sort of a testament to how little anybody cared about it at Nintendo, or like they didn't really have high expectations. But the flip side of that is because the Game Boy had such a huge installed user base, you know, there was really no hurdle to acquiring the game, especially if you were a little kid. And, you know, I think Pokemon's success in huge part is due to that, like, enormous, like, installed base. I mean, how many Game Boys already been sold by 1997, 96 when
you know,
came
it
out?
Was, I mean, it was tens and tens of millions.
Yes.
Well, wait, I didn't realize, yeah, Jeremy, you just said before that it was the best-selling piece of game hardware of the 20th century, and I'm sure it had sold, like, a lion's share of the number of consoles or number of handhelds it would sell before Pokemon came out.
Well, no, I think probably it had sold about, I don't know exactly, but about half of its total numbers by
that
point.
That's what I'm saying,
But definitely not the lion's share. Like, Pokemon and Game Boy Pocket and then Game Boy Color, they kind of lump those all together. Like, had a huge impact on the system. Like, you know, the original Game Boy hardware was viable for a decade. That's really kind of amazing.
It's unprecedented, really. So what is the bridge? What I am really not familiar, and this is where I kind of hope Jeremy can fill me in on this, like the kind of genesis of the Virtual Boy and all of that. Because that's, if you want to talk about swan songs of Yokoi at Nintendo, what's the story there?
Well, no, his actual swan song was the Wonder Swan, and that was
a different company.
Yes.
Yes.
So there's a pretty long story behind Virtual Boy, but to make it short, It was basically the Yokoi version of virtual reality. Like, how can we take some existing technology that's inexpensive and accessible to the, you know, to the mainstream consumer audience and use that to simulate something that's a just good enough version of 3D. I think the project kind of slipped along the way, and I think it was Yokoi who compared it to a frog slowly being boiled. You know, the temperature just goes up 1 degree at a time, and you don't really notice it, but in the end, you know, the frog boils. And it was pretty much the same thing with Virtual Boy, where they kept cutting features and changing elements, and eventually what ended up shipping was so far removed from what the original plan was, they were like, whoa, how did this happen? This is not what it was supposed to be. But Yokoi, you know, Hiroshi Yamauchi, the company president, really wanted some sort of 3D functionality. Nintendo had been dabbling in 3D for quite a while. There was a 3D system for Famicom.
The shutter goggles for the Famicom.
Yeah, right. The LED shutters.
Those are really cool looking. I've never used them. Have you?
I have some, but I haven't actually sat down and used them yet. They're on the list of things to do.
The Master System had similar goggles,
it did,
too,
and
didn't it?
Those came out in the U.S. The Famicom goggles did not come out in the U.S. But anyway, like the idea of 3D was very appealing to Nintendo. They really wanted to do it. So basically, Yokoi connected with a Massachusetts-based firm called Reflection Technologies, who had this device that basically was a headset that would allow you to use, like, you know, head-mounted virtual reality on a consumer level. And that's fine, but it just...
Or was it?
Well, it turned out not to be viable as a consumer video game product. For one thing, they couldn't do the head mounting because the device was so heavy. The original concept for Virtual Boy was to make it head mounted, so you would wear it. But
they meant to have head tracking stuff.
Well,
but that's kind of the defining thing of virtual reality, and without that, you're already lost half the game right there.
A consumer level chip, like processor, was not fast enough to do head tracking. That's one problem.
Yeah,
they basically used the same chip that was in the PCFX, kind of a failed console/computer hybrid from NEC. It was, you know, a 32-bit chip, so compared to Game Boy, it was really impressive, but for head tracking, didn't quite do that. But also another problem was there's a piece by Binge Edwards, Retronauts regular, on Fast Company, where he talked to some people who worked on Virtual Boy in different capacities, but apparently there were concerns, you know, from like the FCC about the fact that you had this radiation emitting device that you were wearing on your head. And so they had to shield components with metal. And all of a sudden,
that's why it was so heavy.
And all of a sudden, it was way too heavy to be a headset. So it was no longer head mounted. It no longer had head tracking. You know, they wanted full color LED or LCDs, but anything besides red was way too expensive. You know, the alternate colors, like, you know, RGB LEDs became affordable like a year after Game Boy or Virtual Boy came out. So they just kind of missed the boat on that. But it ended up being like basically monochrome black and white, but drenched in bright searing red. So it was just...
Yeah, it was kind of like the Bloody Wedding or something like that. It was really not pleasant to look at.
It was just kind of a mess. But the Virtual Boy did have a lot of interesting ideas to it.
Wasn't one of the issues Nintendo had that they were worried kids would like fall down stairs if they had it strapped to their head too?
That's one of the other things I read was, even all the other tech stuff aside, Nintendo's lawyers, once they saw what the whole idea of this thing was supposed to be, they were like, there's no way in hell we're letting you guys sell something that can like essentially make kids blind and deaf. Because even aside from the first accident that might happen that you could actually maybe blame on the Virtual Boy, the moment some kid falls down the stairs and blames it on the Virtual Boy, we're dead. So this cannot obscure people's visions or like mess with their hearing. Like this has to be something they just stick their face into. They can't just like walk around with this on their...
Changed when Pokemon Go came out and like people started walking into like nuclear waste dumps and stuff looking for...
God, who knows? Yeah. And that's even aside from the death of a thousand cuts with the technology thing where everything just kind of kept on like just not falling apart, but like they end up having to cut away so much of the, you know, stuff that was actually going to make it actually fun to play. And just, everything, whereas like Gunpei Yokoi was so lucky with the Game & Watch and the Game Boy and how stripping it down to its basic components just, if anything, just turn those other devices into just its purest versions of themselves. The same thing happening with the Virtual Boy just tore the thing apart, so by the end there wasn't really nothing left except for a brain-frying red screen.
Yeah.
That just sat on it.
No. That is not true. That is not... There is a lot... There is a lot to admire about Virtual Boy. For one thing, it is a system, a consumer-level system, that provided 3D visualization, 3D graphics in 1995. There wasn't anything comparable to that. It was not the right solution, but it still achieved something admirable. It also, like, you could see Nintendo's designers, Yokoi's team, kind of approaching the realities of 3D gaming in a sort of naive way that sort of was a precursor to what we would see in the mainstream gaming space. The controller, it didn't have analog controls, but it had two D-pads, one for the left and one for the right, which is really, that is a sort of primitive version of the way modern controllers are designed, where you have the left stick and the right stick. And they kind of intuited that you would need two different control pads to be able to control, you know, movement and visualization in a 3D space. And, you know, the hardware wasn't really up to it, and the design chops weren't there. People weren't really sure how to design games yet for true 3D. So the console and the controller weren't really, you know, they weren't taken full advantage of. They weren't used to their maximum potential, but they were getting there. Like, this is, the Virtual Boy is an important step that I think people tend to overlook. There were some good innovative ideas to it. It wasn't around long enough, and it wasn't the right product. It wasn't, a successful consumer product. So
Do you think it would have done better if it hadn't been called Virtual?
I don't know about that. I think it needed not to be a device that you shove your face into and get a headache after 15 minutes. I've been saying this ever since I hooked up the Virtual Tap to a Virtual Boy and recorded video through RGB on a television system. Like, when you strip it down to black and white, it becomes a Game Boy. And if they had skipped the Game Boy, like the 3D element, and just made it like a handheld Game Boy successor with the same visual resolution, but just one screen, black and white, just like Hyper Game Boy or something, I think it would have done amazingly well. Like, if you could have played that Wario Land game on just a normal portable system, lose the 3D gimmickry, which isn't even really that important in that game, like, that would have been not necessarily mind-blowing, but it would have been so much better than any other portable system at the time. And, you know, a big part of Virtual Boy's battery drain, the short battery life, was because there were spinning mirrors and, like, light systems inside of it, and it was supporting two backlit mirror spinning screens at the same time. Like, that's super battery hungry. You take away those mechanical components and you have a system that probably would have had pretty good battery life, a pretty powerful 32-bit processor, a nice widescreen video system, and that would have been an amazing handheld system. That could have been their next generation Game Boy. That could have been what they did instead of Game Boy Pocket. They could have made, like, Game Boy cargo pants or something. Like, you know, you need more than one pocket for this thing. You need a lot of pockets. But this is it. This is the new thing, man. Like, that I think that could have done really well. And it's a shame that, you know, they got so hung up on the virtual reality aspect of it, the 3D aspect of it, because it just, like, as we've seen time and again, 3D is a gimmick. No one really, really wants it much.
No, nobody wanted it on TVs either.
No. Ever since the 1950s, it's been failing in the market.
So do you think the Virtual Boy also helped kill the VR fad in America? Because I certainly, if you were...
It certainly didn't help.
It was such a hyped buzzword back then, and we all knew it wasn't really working. There were, like, a couple of kind of commercial, like, arcade level attempts to make it work, but, like, I think everybody knew, like, home VR was completely overhyped. And then when the Virtual Boy came out, it just felt like, to me anyway, I was like, wow, this is just like, this. That's it. Virtual reality, done.
Well, I know Yokoi himself had repeatedly said that he blamed the Virtual Boy. I don't know if he ever said anything specific about the name, but he definitely did say the marketing that positioned the system as a virtual reality machine was, he blamed part of the failure of the system on that, just because it was selling people something that system was not never really meant to be. And there's a quote with him saying something, if he had a billion yen to invest in marketing, that he could have decided how that marketing would have gone. He thinks he could have actually salvaged the system. Who knows how popular it would have been, but at least it wouldn't have cratered the way it had.
I mean, it felt so retrograde. It felt like using one of those, like, coin-operated peep show booths, you know?
You know what? With the leaning into the thing? Yeah, no, as an avowed fan of those things, I grew up playing those things at Kennywood Park in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. That's, I never occurred to me, but that is exactly... And well, also, it's all got all the drawbacks of even modern virtual reality, where it's asocial, no one else can see what you're doing, you're kind of closing yourself off to everyone else around you.
Very isolating.
It's impossible to show off to strangers.
Yeah, there was really no way to share it. Famously, like, Sony had a really hard time marketing the Walkman in the late 70s because nobody knew what it was. And so Sony, they actually hired people to walk around the Ginza and, like, offer people a hit on their earphones so they could see what it was like to listen to music outside of your house. And that worked. That is how they sparked... You know, the Walkman did become a big fad in Japan, but there's no way to do that with a Virtual Boy.
I want to point out, too, before we move on through the little details about this stuff, going through Jeremy's Virtual Boy Works video project on YouTube really made me appreciate, like, Jeremy just touched upon this briefly, but yeah, the graphic work they were doing for that system, the games in that system, there are some great-looking games, and some of the best Nintendo sprite work I've ever seen has been in, like, Mario Clash and that Wario Land game. And even that just alone just kind of kills me. I know Nintendo did more advanced, you know, pixel stuff with, like, you know, Game Boy Advance games and stuff afterwards. But, like, yeah, Jeremy's absolutely right. Virtual Boy, if it had just been served up in a different format, could have been a thing. I don't know how big of a thing, but it definitely wouldn't have died on the operating table.
Could have been a contender.
Yeah, I would chalk that up more to Yamauchi trying to shove a bad idea through the system than anything Yogi Yokoi did. Yokoi did as much as he could given the bad idea that was served to him.
That poor frog.
That's a roasted frog. There's nothing left of that frog. That frog is
boiled.
Oh my God.
So, like, there was a lot of rumors that Yokoi left the company because of the Virtual Boy, but he wrote an impassioned kind of editorial for a famous Japanese literary magazine called Bungei Shunju. And in it, he specifically said, no, I didn't leave because of that. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But he said there was no bad blood between him and Nintendo. Did you guys hear anything to the contrary?
I mean, I don't think Virtual Boy went well for him. But again, you know, he did follow that up with Game Boy Pocket. So it's not like they were just like, get the hell out of here. They let him head up another project, and it was a huge success for him and for Nintendo. So it's hard to imagine Nintendo was just like, oh, well, you did all this great stuff for us for all these years, but this project, this one project you were given, didn't turn out well, so you suck. That just doesn't seem to be their culture.
No.
And
no. Japanese companies don't fire people. You just didn't fire people back then.
Yeah, he got the corner office.
Yes.
The corner office.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing I've always heard, is they didn't fire him. They just humiliated him until he left by forcing him to show off the Virtual Boy at the one or two trade shows. Probably the only one, because it was only on shelves for less than a year. Probably Space World, right? That's where Yokoi was actually showing off the floor display model.
Right.
Well, again, I have no idea how true that is, but that's always been how I've always heard it framed. It was that he was essentially shamed out of the company because the Japanese don't fire people.
Yeah, I do wonder,
especially because, like, I don't know what the hell he was up to in the couple years leading up to the Virtual Boy and Game Boy Pocket, because what was he doing this during the Super Nintendo years?
In his autobiography, he said he was in the wilderness, so to speak.
Kind of wondering, because
he was really depressed, is what he said. Because, like, Miyamoto and everybody were getting all of the spotlight, And
that
would thought,
better. Yeah, I could see that. That makes me think maybe, okay, maybe he was like, he came back just to do the Virtual Boy in the Game Boy Pocket. And then he was, I could see in that situation, I can see who his eye was already on the door. Cause he was, what, he was like 50 or so when that happened.
Mid 50s, yeah.
Yeah, I could see him thinking about like Nintendo's growing and changing, the industry's changing, Nintendo's going up against Sony, everything's becoming 3D, the Nintendo's own games are becoming much more complicated and stuff. I could totally see him thinking, I don't want to necessarily retire, but I want to go back to square one.
Yeah, and that's exactly what he did with his company that he started after Nintendo, Koto, who, you know, where he basically put together little gadgets and projects, little LCD games using more contemporary technology, but also collaborated with Bandai to create basically the ultimate realization of the classic Game Boy, which was the Wonder Swan, which was basically a Virtual Boy powered, you know, like equivalent processor on a, you know, a tiny portable system that had, it just did so much. It was like basically the same, roughly the same resolution as the Virtual Boy screen. So you could have big sprites. You could have more levels of gray. I think it could do 16 shades of grayscale or 8 as opposed to 4. It had a rotatable orientation. It had basically 3 sets of buttons. There was one set of buttons that was just a D-pad, one set of buttons that was just like an A and a B, and then another set of buttons in between that could be either A, B buttons or a D-pad. So you could rotate the screen and the whole system and play in vertical mode or horizontal mode. And you could just kind of seamlessly do that, which, you know, it's really interesting, but it makes the idea of emulating Wonder Swan on some sort of dedicated system really hard to imagine how to do, because that rotation is so important. But it ran on a single AA battery for like 30 hours. It's ridiculous how energy efficient that thing was. And it sold, I think, you know, the base price for it when it launched was like $60. It was really cheap. And, you know, it had a pretty blurry screen at first, but then they released the Wonder Swan Color, which, you know, was still very energy efficient. I think it could do like 15 hours on a AA battery. And then the Swan Crystal, which had even better quality. But, you know, it was a very, very inexpensive competitor to Game Boy that, you know, I don't know why they didn't release it outside of Japan, but I feel like it could have done okay for itself. It did reasonably well in Japan. Like, it's not hard to find Wonder Swans and Wonder Swan games, you know, compared to Neo Geo Pocket Color. It's much more readily purchasable.
I was in Japan a lot around that time. I hadn't moved here yet, but I was traveling for work and stuff a lot. And I just remember seeing the Wonder Swan coming out and just feeling like it was the answer to a question that had already been settled. Like, putting aside the fact that it was a really great, like, system, that the specs were cool, it just felt like, well, I already have a Game Boy, you know what I mean? Like, why do I need this? And I think the real thing that killed it was the software. I mean, as well done as some of the games that were on there, like, you just didn't feel like it had
it was Bandai.
You know, the ecosystem just wasn't there, you know, like a more dedicated, because I never really associated Bandai with gaming. Of course, they made games. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but they were always variants of their toy licenses. Just shit tons of Evangelion games and things like that. Just licensed anime product after licensed anime product. And it's just, you know, whereas Nintendo thrived on game properties original, that were games first and foremost, Bandai was very much about, like, hey, kids, you love, you know, Kinnikuman? Here you go. Here's Kinnikuman. Hey, you love whatever.
And those games do
Hello
gangbusters.
Kitty.
They do really, I mean, you know, Alt Japan, our localization company, a big chunk of our career was spent localizing Gundam games. You know, the Gundam
so
Dynasty
many of them.
Warriors.
There's never a shortage.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and so, like, I get it. I get why companies do that. But that was, I think, a big reason why, you know, even to somebody who kind of had more of an understanding of how the game industry worked, I was kind of like, what is this competing with? Like, how are they going to compete with, like, the Game Boy?
Right, and it really limited...
What's their niche, yeah.
It limited the appeal of the system to just Japan, because most of those properties, you know, that was the late 90s, they didn't have traction in the US yet. Like, maybe now a system that kind of leaned on Gundam and Dragon Ball would do okay for itself, but
right.
In 1999, no, it wasn't there.
No.
Yeah, the only games I've ever heard about it for didn't they pour over a couple Final Fantasy games?
They did. That was because Squaresoft and Nintendo were having a pissing match over the PlayStation.
That's right.
And the abandonment of, Squaresoft abandoning Nintendo to be on PlayStation. So they couldn't make Game Boy games. Instead, they made WonderSwan games. And when WonderSwan went away, they finally sucked up their pride and said, okay, you win, Nintendo. We'll
eat crow.
Lay ourselves on the altar of commerce for you.
Eat chocobo? Is that what the equivalent of eating
yes.
crow is?
We will make Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles for you.
It really makes you wonder if Yokoi, if the tragedy hadn't happened, if Yokoi hadn't died in that traffic accident, so young and so soon after like this brainchild of his launched, like maybe he would have been able to turn it around, or maybe he was too entrenched in old. Toy-based ways of thinking to turn it around again. I don't know.
I would imagine cell phones would have thrown a big kink into that. I mean, I think the WonderSwan would have lasted longer, but the oncoming... You would know more about that than I would, because I'm not quite sure up on, like, what early 21st century Japanese cell phone culture was like, but a dedicated handheld that just plays games that would... sounds like you kind of could play most of them on your phone in just a couple years... Because what, this came out in the WonderSwan was what, 1999?
Yep, 99.
Sounds like the WonderSwan would have had a pretty short shelf life, even if it had been successful at the start. Well, but then you never know. Like the company could have just turned into a cell phone game company or something like that, or who knows? But
Japan had already kind of wholeheartedly pivoted into kind of what the prototype of social media was back then. Like we didn't have like Facebook or Twitter or anything in America at that point. But Japan was like that. 1999 is also when Ni Channel came out, 2-channel, which, as we know, kind of revolutionized how people interact online. And like things like emoji.
Like the precursor to 4chan?
Yeah,
the Chan stuff, right?
Yes, yeah.
Okay,
Ni Channel had, it was all text-based, but they had an image board called Futaba Channel, and that code is what Moot, who founded 4chan, used to launch 4chan. And, emoji and, like, all sorts of, like, you know, they had the flip phone culture going on, and, like, really, and the girls were, like, using these print club machines and exchanging, like, selfies of each other. So, like, that kind of, like... socialization of tech for young people had already kind of really accelerated in Japan at that point. And it makes you wonder what would have happened if they had developed, Japanese companies developed a smartphone that worked before the iPhone came in and basically just completely monoculturized the smartphone ecosystem.
That's what I'm saying. And there would have been time for Yokoi's company to develop some kind of niche for itself before Apple came in and swept everything away. But even then, again, I mean, I just wanted him to survive long enough to do an Iwata Asks. That's, if I could go back in time and change anything, like, that's, because if anyone knows where the bodies would be buried and have good stories to tell in those things.
And also, he wasn't working for Nintendo anymore. That's the key thing. So, like, you know, when I was researching my book, I always heard the greatest stories from retired Sony people or retired Nintendo people. It was never, like, you can't get a straight answer out of anybody working out of a company, not because they're deceptive, but because, you know, that's their meal ticket. And like, they have loyalty to their company and all of that kind of thing. So they're not going to tell you anything that's beyond the company line.
And if Yamauchi had still been in charge of the company, I don't think anyone would come back to tell stories about the company too much. But with Iwata in charge of Nintendo, I could totally see him saying, hey, I know you, I love you, I respect you enough. Like, why don't you come back? We could talk. Who knows? He could have brought back Yokoi to actually work for the company. Who knows? But there's just the untapped potential there. Even though Yokoi was a little bit older then, who knows what could have happened.
Just, one of those big what ifs.
Yeah, maybe the, within the gaming industry, if not the biggest one, definitely one of them.
Yeah.
Oof-a-doo.
Yeah, well, that's kind of a bummer to end on, but boys, we've been doing this for 2 solid hours. Look at us.
I know, and that's on top of the previous hour and a half we did before. So I think that is enough talking about kind of Gunpei Yokoi and also a lot of things around Gunpei Yokoi.
Yes.
I think it's good to focus on individual creators from time to time. And I can't think of anyone more appropriate to start with than Yokoi. I mean, he's not as big a household name as Miyamoto or Kojima or someone, but in a lot of ways, I feel like his work was much closer to the heart of what video gaming is really about and what makes gaming good. And you look back at things like Game & Watch, you look back at Game Boy, and even the things we talked about last episode, his, you know, pre-video game stuff, there's just so much inventiveness to it and so much of an ability to say, what are the needs of players? Like, what is it that players want, and how can I deliver that to them in the most efficient way possible that's going to be affordable for as many people as possible? And that's a really rare ability, and he had a great instinct for that. And it's hard to imagine what video gaming would be if he hadn't had influence, you know, if he hadn't been part of it.
Yeah, he's kind of singular presence, isn't he? And as somebody who kind of got interested in Japan because of toys, because I'm old enough to, you know, have been a kid when before video games were really a big thing, certainly home gaming, like that kind of fusion of physical toys and that kind of intersection, the Venn diagram is just, it's something only really he did. And like, you know, all of these arguments over, you know, who programmed what or who made what, I totally agree that he probably wasn't the singular driving force on a lot of this stuff. But that idea that he was a toy man before he was a game man is, I think, a really unique thing in the game industry.
And yeah, he was a toy maker, and like I said before, it was his thing that he served more than anything else was play. And that is at the heart of gaming more than anything else. That is the great unifier, and the fact that, like, yeah, he managed to kind of shape Nintendo's ethos, and that's Nintendo's driving force too. And so, yeah, his shadow looms large over the industry, and his impact will always be felt in the best ways possible. He seems like a pretty cool dude. I'm glad he was around.
Yeah, always going to be one of my regrets that I was never able to interview him, but...
Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
Nevertheless, we have many of his works and the works that he helped create and contributed to enjoy, and, you know, I continue to encounter new ones, or, you know, new old ones, and, you know, having just recently kind of dabbled in Game & Watch for the first time properly has been really satisfying and really makes me appreciate just, you know, the kind of creativeness and the kind of thoughtfulness that went into his work. Anyway, that is an overview of the work of Gunpei Yokoi. Thanks, Bill, and thank you, Matt, both for contributing to this this dynamic and exciting 3.5-hour adventure.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, and... So, yes, thanks everyone for listening once again to our discussion of Gunpei Yokoi and Nintendo's history. You've been very patient, and hopefully you have enjoyed the fruits of your patience. Anyway, this has been a Retronauts episode. I have been Jeremy Parrish. I will continue to be Jeremy Parrish. And you will be able to continue to find Retronauts in all the usual places, including Retronauts.com, on the Greenlit Podcast Network, on... podcatchers, and so on and so forth. And of course, on Patreon, where you can subscribe to us, get early access to every episode, get bonus material, things like that, depending on the tier you subscribe to. You know, if you subscribe at a high enough level and there are any slots available, you can even request an episode topic, except you cannot request Gunpei Yokoi because we have covered that topic in its entirety. So Matt, where could we find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter. I'm Matt_Alt. You can find me on Instagram, AltMattAlt. And you can find me in your favorite local bookstore. You can find my book, Pure Invention, How Japan's Pop Culture Conquered the World. Please check it out.
An amazing book. I highly recommend it. And Bill, how about you?
I'm just Mudron, my last name, Mudron, on Twitter.com. You can find art prints that I sell on mudron@bigcartel.com. And I have my own podcast called Tardy to the Party, in which me and my co-host, we talk about things that we always meant to watch or listen to or read before, and we finally get around to doing that stuff, although our podcast is half mutated into us talking about Disney stuff these days. But yeah, but we also talk about video game things and stuff like that. So yeah, check out tardytotheparty.com.
In fairness, everything, and... like almost everything is a Disney thing these days.
That's
they do
the unfortunate.
Own all of the world at this point, don't they?
Yeah, we're slowly going through the chronological Disney through the decades collection. So within the last 6 months, we've actually managed to work our way from up from the very first Disney cartoons all the way up to Cinderella. So,
oh, wait, are you doing only cartoons? You're not doing like Herbie?
Yeah, how does Davy Crockett hold up?
Treasure Island is going to be our next thing, so we have to decide if we're going to do all the live action
stuff. You got to tell me about Darby O'Gill and the little people.
What about the computer who wore tennis shoes?
If it's on Disney Plus, technically we're going to have to cover it sometime. So
don't forget the black hole.
Oh, I just rewatched that recently. It's great.
It's tough.
It's terrible, but it's great.
Is that on Disney?
Yeah, the designs are iconic. The ship, the robots.
Oh yeah, that gothic crazy cathedral ship. It's amazing.
Okay, next podcast, the black hole.
I wish there were games about black hole. No, I don't think there are.
I know.
There should be, because I would love to talk about that movie.
Just have people pitch their ideas for a black hole game. You are Ernest Borgnine.
I imagine something like Halo, except you're like a hovering like robot that looks like Oscar the Grouch.
Or you could do like Fruit Ninja, except you're Maximilian with the spinning death hands.
Totally. God. It had the most like weird ending. We're way off topic here.
We're trying to end this. We just started a black hole podcast now, all of a sudden.
Yeah.
I am totally down to talk about black hole sometime, though. Great. Great.
Anytime,
terrible movie.
Anytime.
All right, gentlemen. Awesome. Thanks for having us. Yes, it was a pleasure, and I hope to have you both on again sometime, together or separately. It doesn't matter. It'll just be great. All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening.